We are now ready for argument in case number 10-2087. Ms. Freeman? Why don't you proceed with your argument, and if we have questions, we're not shy.
Well, make sure you made that point you're making right there. I'm trying to understand why you would stop there and ask that question.
What
you've said is self-evident, that the fact that there's no allegation regarding contracts, I guess those 2004 contracts, in which that very subordinated clause is in, you didn't contest that, then what would be the basis for doing so if it's included in a note?
Thank you. That's exactly the same.
So why is that not appropriate for, you know, I guess you were saying if we look at it in light most favorable on a 12b6, but, I mean, it may be sufficient to convert it to summary judgment if that's necessary, if that fact is evident from the beginning, that is right there in the contract, same subordinate clause, put it in a note, and you've got a problem with it in a note, but not in the contract.
Thank you, Ron. First of all, we wouldn't expect it to be converted to a summary judgment because the contracts were attached to and incorporated into the complaint. And our premise on that is that everything that's attached to the complaint is essentially part of the complaint. There wasn't any outside evidence to be considered. So it wouldn't be right for summary judgment. We didn't have an opportunity to get any evidence to attach. But as to the other part of your question, the subordination clauses are not identical. And the 04 contracts don't define the Schumann note, which is in quotation marks in the later documents. They define subordinated debt obligation. And if I may refer to the record, I can quote Your Honor the part of it, which is so significant. Page 44 of the appendix, under section 3.04, which is the section that includes the definition of subordinated debt obligation. It said, John B. Schumann shall have the option but not the obligation to make loans to the company, and his such amounts and on such terms as are described in this section 3.04. And it goes on and says, in parentheses, subordinated debt obligation. So that tells us what we're talking about. But it also continues in that very same paragraph to say, the duration of the subordinated debt obligation will be for a period of up to 3 years. And it goes on. At no time shall the total subordinated debt obligation exceed $3 million. So what we have here is a definition that says that John Schumer can create a debt for the company that can last up to 3 years and be up to $3 million as of 2004. The Schumer note is referred to later, but it's not defined. All debt could mean debt to anyone, and that's not defined. And we definitely know that 2007 is more than 3 years after this was created. So that's part of the reviewability. Additional ambiguity comes in from the extrinsic facts which we allege. And those extrinsic facts are the facts of coercion and misrepresentation. And these are material misrepresentations, by the way. These are not misrepresentations that are insignificant or tertiary. We've alleged that the individual defendants told Mr. Carty that the companies were prepared to and able to and intended to make the payments in the amount stated in the notes on the date that they became due, which was January 2008, even though there was this undefined reference to all debt. That lends some ambiguity as well. Additionally, one of the problems that creates ambiguity is that in the buyout notice, there is a reference to the paragraphs of the 04 documents which describe how Mr. Carty's rights will end. And the buyout says, essentially, that these paragraphs say that once we have paid you, your rights as a member cease. And it goes on to say, by signing this, you recognize that your rights have ceased. So, if the court below is allowed to say, I will get rid of all of these causes of action because I do not believe the allegations of coercion in light of the subordination agreements that existed before, in light of Mr. Carty's obligations to execute documents reasonably presented to him if he is bought out, if the court is allowed to say, I don't believe coercion because it doesn't make sense to me, then why is the court not allowed to say, I don't believe a businessman would sign such a thing unless he were coerced?
You allege that Carty was coerced with respect to the 2007 agreement, the execution of the promissory notes. Is that correct?
Promissory notes, yes, ma'am. The termination agreement and the buyout.
Okay.
All of those things were presented to him at the same time, taken away, and then presented again. And he was told, take it or leave it, this is all you get.
Is that the reason for the discrepancy in the dates? I mean, Carty signed documents on December 29th and then Dunn signed them 4 days later?
No, ma'am. We don't allege that he signed anything on December 29th. We have alleged that he signed everything on or about January 2007. The focus for us, the thing we find most significant, is that the documents were presented to him very briefly.
Well, I'm looking at the joint appendix, which appears to indicate Mr. Carty's signature on December
29th. I'm sorry, which page number? 229. Yes, you are right about that. I'm sorry. the documents were all executed together with the effective date being January 2007.
Well, but the signature for, it appears that the signature for Dunn is the 2nd of January.
Yes.
On the same page.
Yes, the effective date is to be January 2, but my point is that Mr. Carty executed all of the documents he executed on the same day.
Okay, you don't allege any coercion with respect to the, I mean, you allege coercion with respect to the 2007 agreements. You did not allege coercion or duress with respect to the notice of buyout, correct?
Yes, we do. We do allege coercion with regard to that. What we're saying is that all of these things were presented to him simultaneously and executed under duress simultaneously. If there was any discrepancy in the date of signature, it would have been by a day or so, and I don't believe there was any difference in those dates. But nevertheless, the court below found that Mr. Carney had these documents for 2 weeks and that was adequate time over the holidays for him to consult the counsel and gotten some advice about this. That's not what we've alleged. We've alleged that he had them very briefly and he was not given an opportunity to consult counsel. And that it's a reasonable, from our perspective, it's a reasonable inference that nobody who's paying attention would sign such a thing unless they were under duress. And the court is not to take our facts as true except for where it can make reasonable inferences on behalf of the defendant. That's not the way North Carolina
is it North Carolina law or is it Indiana law?
Well, that's another good question. In some aspects, in some respects, that isn't just determinative because Indiana law and North Carolina law on these topics are very similar. They both proceed, both states proceed by saying if it is reasonably inferable that this person may later prove his case, then he goes forward. In neither state is there an obligation for us to plead a prima facie case of breach of contract or anything else. We are to plead basic facts, and there isn't any enhanced burden of pleading except with regard to things like fraud under Rule 9, which, from our perspective, we did with like date, time, and specific.
So you say there are some stark differences between the subordinated clause in the note and the clauses that existed under the 2004 agreements.
Stark differences?
Material differences.
Material differences. Because the things that...
And to the extent that it does not differ and you do not contest those, then it's okay, I take it.
I'm sorry, I don't understand.
To the extent, if the difference in the two agreements is maybe one sentence, then everything you didn't contest, which you don't contest, anything about the subordinate clauses from the language on the subordinate clause in the 2004 agreement, that's okay insofar as having been included in a note, it is that part about it that is different that you have a problem with.
I see that my time is up.
Please respond to the question. Thank you.
We don't disagree and we don't dispute the language in the 2004 documents or any aspect of those 2004 documents. We recognize that they're fully enforceable and that's what we'd like to do.
And those were not coerced.
Those were not coerced.
He signed a subordinate agreement on the 2004 the operating agreement and the other one. And that language in there, nothing you can see, that was not coerced.
Correct. Okay. We also
but that which is in the note you say was coerced.
The notes themselves were coerced. We didn't have to sign those notes. We were obligated to sign something, but not that, and not then. We were allowed by the 2004 documents many rights, which include the right to be free from misrepresentations and coercion. And if Mr. Carty had not been coerced, he would have been able to say, wait a minute, I don't understand what this means.
You probably wouldn't have had a problem with those notes if you could have gotten paid in full on them, though. Your problem is a subordinated clause, right?
There are many problems. But
But if you could have gotten all the money off of that note, you wouldn't be standing in front of us, is what you're telling us. So there's nothing coerced about the note. It's that subordinate clause in there that diminished the value of this note that you've got a problem with, right?
It's that clause which is so ambiguous that we'd like to have it thrown out.
I'm just trying to narrow, make sure I understand. Because you said the note was coerced. The note looked like it was a pretty good deal. If you could get the money from it, your problem is that subordinate, right?
I don't mean to mince words with the court. What we're saying is that his signature on that particular note was coerced, and if he'd had an opportunity to negotiate, he would have negotiated a different subordination clause. Yes, the actual payment terms, the actual dollar numbers.
He was happy with.
We're not complaining about. He was not happy with them because it was reduced.
But it wasn't coerced. The payment term.
It was allowed by the 2004 document.
Which you didn't contest.
Which we cannot contest.
Which was not coerced.
Correct.
Therefore, this was not coerced, at least in terms of the payment.
Payment was not coerced.
That's all I needed to know.
The ambiguity was coerced. The ambiguity was coerced.
Okay.
Thank you. You've reserved some time for rebuttal.
Mr. Court, we also thank you for the opportunity to be here today to address these issues in this matter. The motion to dismiss was properly granted. The amended complaint was original. The amended complaint did not meet the legal requirements to state causes of action that were in there. It was practical.
I would find it helpful if you would speak more directly into the mic, if you would.
Oh, okay. Sure.
Thank you. Right. I'm having trouble hearing you.
What we have here is sophisticated business people who agreed in 2004 to certain rights and obligations under the agreement. One of them was a buyout clause. And it's not disputed that the buyout clause would be triggered upon termination of a member. And it's not disputed that the termination of the member, Mr. Cardi, in this instance, was promised. The parties, my clients, followed the 2004 agreement correctly. You'll look at the promissory notes. You'll see that they promised they paid 20% in cash of the net value at that time, which is not in dispute. And they gave a promissory note subordinating for the remaining 80%. That's what the 2004 documents required. That's exactly what they've done. And the attempt to build causes of action by the parties to do what was required fails as a matter of law, which the magistrate judge properly found and the district court judge properly found as well.
Are there some different material terms insofar as the subordination clause in the note from that existed in the 2004 agreement? I mean, I think it was suggested about the 3-year limitation in terms of the amount that Mr. Schumann would have to note and the continuing that there were differences in that note that amounted to coercion for Mr. Carter.
Well, there's those things separate. Because you asked things which I think are two different issues about the note and coercion. But let me address the note first. There were what we consider minor differences. Most of them were beneficial to the note holder. If there's an issue about coercion, I'll just address that right now. Mr. Carter didn't have to sign promises. He was the holder of it. So look, his signature is not an agreement. His signature is a witness to that note. They agreed to make the promissory notes, which they did. They included some provisions in there, which were brought out in the briefing, that they didn't have to put in it. They don't override the subrogation. Subrogation is in this very specific.
That's an interesting point you just made. You're saying the person giving the note, you don't have to sign to get a note.
That's correct.
So the fact that the signature is coerced doesn't mean anything.
Well, even if it were coerced, but it wasn't, okay? Because it was given to him, and we could have just given, our clients could have just given the note, here's a note, here's the amount for owed, without obtaining his signature at all. That's correct.
So where would the cause of action lie if you felt that what was being delivered by the note to try to comply with the subordination clause, well, I suppose you would have to bring action on the 2004 agreement?
You would breach your contract.
I see.
That's not what was being brought.
How was Mr. Cardi supposed to enforce his rights under these notes? How was he supposed to determine whether or not the prior debt had been extinguished?
Well, that's an interesting question because it gets to the issue. I didn't finish answering the prior question about the subordinated debt. The quote that you were, I may just finish that. The quote that was given regarding subordination of debt from Mr. Schumann came from a different document. One came from a shareholder agreement. She read from the operating agreement when she was up here. That alleges that it can be increased by consent of the parties. There's been no allegation that the Schumann debt was anything improper. Furthermore, the 2004 agreement, which defined the subordination, was much broader, including all debts and liabilities of the company, not just Mr. Schumann's note. So we don't think that change materially affected any of the rights of the plaintiff. But how would he enforce that? There was a second agreement as well that was entered into, and that's the termination. The termination agreement was separate and apart from the 2004 agreement. And that provided, as an employee, that they were going to give him two things, $75,000, which he received in exchange for that termination agreement. Plus, he was released as a guarantor from the bank obligations, which at that time were about $8 million and exceeded perhaps, and by the time of the hearing, in the transcript, you'll see it grew to about $13 million. So there was no question. This was the real estate development business, which was booming in the city, so we all know what happened to it after. So the debt was increased, and he knew very well what the debt was when he signed those documents. That's not a matter of record, but as a shareholder, he did know that, and as a guarantor of the debt, he would know what it was. Now, so when you're asking the question, he went back and amended now, how would he change that? He could not allege now that he knows that that debt, you couldn't say that it would never be repaid, but the likelihood that it would be repaid is it was not present, at least in 2006. So he could not reasonably rely upon any statement that was made to him that, in fact, the debt was going to be paid up soon. He knew what.
So that addresses this issue about the ambiguity or lack of clarity with respect to all debt, because he knew, as a matter of fact, what the debt was?
What addresses that is the fact that all debt was purposely written by the partners in this this corporation, the shareholders, this corporation, that it would be the debt for all investors, and they all have obligations, and they realized their obligations to third parties and to the corporation. And so it wasn't limited. Debt obligations are limited all the time. Guarantee obligations. So if you go to a bank, and you can get the bank to give the bank subordination rights. Often they're very limited. In this case, they were not.
Would it include new debt incurred after Mr. Cardi left the company?
It could. There are sometimes the documents don't do that. They're specifically written in there. They could have been marked. Here it wasn't. It was all debt. That's pretty unending. And so, I don't know if that answers your question. So, in our view, once it's determined that the parties were only doing what they were required, and in fact, go back into coercion on it, Mr. Cardi couldn't argue he was coerced on the promissory note because he got exactly what was required for him to get. And so, how can that amount to a breach of fiduciary duty? Which was an alternative point. In our the suggestion was made that when one fell, they all fell like dominoes. That's because they were all dependent on the contractual agreement. There were just different labels for the same action. And that's exactly what the pleading requirements are meant to avoid, just taking some naked allegations, putting them in your complaint, instead of arguing those are separate causes of action.
Iqbal was decided after your brief. Is my recollection correct? Ashcroft?
It was decided before this briefing was done.
Okay. I noticed, I don't think you cited, did you cite it?
I believe you did.
You did. Thank you.
So from our standpoint, there is no fraud, there is no breach of fiduciary duty because the parties were doing exactly what they were required. And there's some other allegations, the same one, with regard to the tax argument. The tax argument, they were following the law. What we do with the tax, what we do with our allocations, which by the way, no argument or allegation that the allocations made were improper. The argument is that I don't quite follow. You should have backdated so we wouldn't have to pay our allocated taxes. Well, we're following the law in terms of what the IRS says is required of allocation, and the IRS is the one that's going to determine what taxes get paid. We don't do that. So we allocated the money according to what cause inconsistent with our distributions. And those are where private practice certainly understand it would be nice, but you don't have to pay taxes on allocated income. But unfortunately, we do. So that's what it's based on. It's not fraud. It's not constructive fraud, no matter what label that you put on it. That's all I have, unless you have further questions.
Thank you very much. Ms. Freeman, you have some rebuttal time remaining.
Thank you. First, I'd like to point out that most of what Mr. Wolfner said just now was fact and defense, none of which have been actually raised. The quote-unquote facts that he was discussing about how taxes are treated and so on, none of this was properly before the court below because there was no answer ever filed, and none of the K-1s were actually part of the document to the complaint. If these facts are to be before the court, the defendants must file an answer or a motion for a more definite statement requesting that we fill in some details about these K-1s. And in terms of the tax issue there, Mr. Cardi alleged that he was required to pay taxes for income he did not receive, and this benefited the defendants because they kept the money and put the tax burden on us. If that requires more for them to understand it in order to see what the claim is, a motion for a more definite statement is an easy way to go. There's no reason for us to be tossed out of court on the merits when the principle is that cases should be determined on the merits rather than, as the Conley decision said, it's not to be a game of skill where the misstep of counsel throws the case out. That's a misstep of it. And Conley was disfavored by Twombly and Iqbal, but not for that premise. He was disfavored for the idea that a case goes forward unless there's no set of facts that the plaintiff can succeed on. And from our perspective, the burden of pleading, as it is enforced under North Carolina law, would allow this case to go forward. This is not a case like Iqbal or Twombly. This is not a case where we've got a class action for violation of Section 1 of the Sherman Antitrust Act, which requires that we prove that there's a contract, and that's not what they alleged in the complaint. This is not a situation like Iqbal, where we've got issues of government immunity and terrorism and so on. These are common law claims where we have to allege duty and breach and causation. We've alleged facts that are sufficient to show the torts under either North Carolina law or Indiana law, except for, of course, the Chapter 75, Gap 21, claim, which is North Carolina law only. We've alleged that these defendants are in the industry of construction, residential construction in North Carolina. There's no way that that doesn't affect commerce. And we cited cases that show that a court can take judicial notice of the fact that that affects commerce.
You mean a contract that involves parties in and of itself has been held to affect commerce? The intra-contract does?
No, that was not the holding there. But there are a number of other cases, and I've not cited them in my brief, so I don't know whether it's appropriate for me to cite them now. But in general, there are other cases that I'd be happy to submit later. Which say that such things as renting a single unit of residential property affects commerce because it has an effect on the market beyond that.
If that's the basis of the cause of action, but if you're dealing here with an internal dispute between members of a business, that's an entirely different set of facts. And that's the point that they're making, that dispute is not affecting commerce.
Yes, thank you for bringing me back to the point that's really important here. What affects commerce about these disputes is that the relationship among these business owners is important to the business that they're conducting. And the way that they have conducted their business, as we've alleged, the way that they booted this fellow out and defrauded him, and the way that they used a straw man contractor's license in order to run the business thereafter, that affects not only their ability to pay Mr. Carty, because if they can't go forward with their business due to their illegal behavior, they won't have any income and won't be able to pay, but it also affects whether or not these homes get finished, whether or not the people who have contracted with them are able to move forward with their lives and their part of commerce. And no, we didn't allege every single one of those suggestions because it seemed to be obvious. And part of the notice making is that you don't have to plead everything. And if these business people are engaged in commerce by developing residential real estate, but their interactions with each other are fraudulent and illegal and disrupt their own business, that affects commerce too.
But I don't know of a case that says that. And I'm trying to think of where you're going with that. If you dispute it between the, among the parties, it's an internal contract dispute. Surely, if it's a separate action dealing with whether houses are being built, and that's a whole different thing. But isn't this an internal contract dispute between or among people who are partners or shareholders?
Well, there are a number of cases. Thank you. There are a number of cases which talk about the answer to that question turning on whether the person involved, the defendant involved, had some contact, some connection to commerce in his acts. And by the way, those cases say that whether an action is unfair and deceptive and whether it affects commerce is a conclusion of law to be made by the court after the jury finds the facts of what happened to whom and when.
Answered it earlier. The other concern that's made in terms of the note, you made a statement that your client's, Mr. Carter's, signature was coerced on that note. And then the other side said signature is not required on a note.
Signature may not be required on a note, but the terms of the note are required to be fair by common law.
Well, that's a different cause of action than saying my signature was coerced on it, isn't it?
Well, what we're saying, Your Honor, is the 2004 documents give everybody some rights here. And the defendants had the right to throw the plaintiff out. They did. The plaintiff had the right then to promissory notes and other documents to get paid for his interest in the company. I see my time is up.
Please finish your response.
If the documents that were presented to him were not in compliance with what was required by the 2004 documents, which is our position.
In what respect?
The subordination on the notes and the waiver of all rights on the termination agreement and buyout prevent him from having any way of finding out what he is owed, how it can be paid, and so on. We don't know what all debt means. It could mean their finance and a stick of gum into perpetuity so that they never have to pay him. The fact that they made him sign a document which says his rights have ceased means he has no more rights to distributions, no more rights to income, and he can't even see the records. So the statement that he knew what the debt was, he has no right to know what the debt is.
Even if he had a right, he waived it.
Under duress is our point. Duress, fraud, vitiates release. He has some rights, but we need the court to tell us what they are and then enforce them, either under 04 or under 07 with the use of the severability clause.
Thank you very much, Ms. Freeman. The court will come down and greet counsel and proceed directly to the third case.